Every leader I've ever come across wants to thrive in their role. And we've tried everything. We read all these different books and tried all of these different approaches. Well, today, there might be a secret combo that you've never thought of that can unlock your potential and help shape you to be a phenomenal leader. And it's a combination of brilliance and resilience. Our guest, Simon T. Bailey, is going to share with us how that powerful combo of brilliance and resilience could just set you apart. So Simon T. Bailey is a globally recognized expert on brilliance and resilience. Simon's career really took off at the Disney Institute, where he worked with over 2,400 organizations worldwide, helping individuals and teams unlock their full potential. He's been named one of the Success Magazine's top 25 people who can help you achieve both business and life goals alongside thought leaders. Now, this is a pretty good group: Brené Brown, Oprah Winfrey, and even Tony Robbins. Simon is also the author of Resilience at Work, How to Coach Yourself into a Thriving Future. I think it's a must read for anybody who wants to take their career to the next level. I also like how it's written in a fable format. In this episode, Simon will reveal how resilience, the ability to bounce back, and brilliance, defined as creativity, intelligence, and confidence, are the 1-2 punch that leaders need to thrive. In a world where resilience is always center stage, everybody hears about resilience, Simon's going to explain why brilliance is just as crucial for long-term success professionally and personally. Simon is an absolute wealth of knowledge, and he's got a super positive attitude, and I love all the stories he shares with us over the next 45 minutes. And we also get into topics like why self-coaching is so important. He talks about how to understand employees' appreciation languages and why emotional intelligence is a key driver to building resilience. I'm Damon Lemby, CEO of Learnit, and joining me is my partner in crime, also from Learnit, Darren Bridget. And you're listening to the Learn It All podcast, the podcast where great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. So let's dive in, and I hope you really enjoy my buddy Simon T. Bailey's episode today. Let's get started.
Simon, welcome to the show.
Guys, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Simon, we're really appreciative of you being here. And so let's just jump right in. There's a lot of work out there on resilience, but not really as much about brilliance. But it looks like for you, resilience and brilliance are really your 1-2 punch. Can you share with us what is brilliance and why is it so important these days?
Well, let me give you the visual. In life and business, it's like surfing in the ocean. You get knocked off your surfboard. It's your resilience that gets you back on the surfboard, but it's your brilliance that allows you to catch the next wave. So we decided to do some research and we asked working Americans, how do they define brilliance? And working Americans told us brilliance is creativity, intelligence, and confidence. So when an individual has an opportunity to show up in an environment where they are celebrated rather than tolerated, that environment allows them to unlock and become an intrapreneur, finding ways to move the organization forward. And their creativity comes alive in a world where AI is all the rage. People realize that AI is actual intelligence. How do I unlock my creativity, right? And then the whole intelligence piece is understanding intellect is in the mind, but intelligence is in the heart. And when we begin to invite people in an environment that's psychologically safe, they tap into their brilliance.
It's interesting, too, because when you're talking about resilience, a lot of times people are focused on, why aren't we solving this in the workplace? And you're talking about how the workplace really needs to celebrate the individual, and individuals need to take on that intrapreneur kind of attitude to carry forward resilience. It's like a responsibility that goes both ways. Let's let people know your story a little bit. How did you get to this resilience, brilliance place?
So I made a huge mistake while working at Disney. Mickey Mouse rule number one is you never talk to the media. So December 10th, 2001, I get a call from a journalist and he says, where do you see yourself 10 to 15 years from now? And I said, I see myself as the president and CEO of the Walt Disney World Resort and eventually the chairman and CEO of the Walt Disney Company. He puts this in print. So the article comes out, page 12, Florida Business Trend Magazine, February 2002. And my boss calls me to the office. He's like, dude, what were you thinking when you did this interview? And there's my picture with the Mickey Mouse topiary behind me. And I said, Larry, I work at this company whose motto is, if your heart is in your dreams, no request is too extreme, for when you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. But obviously it does here. Now, it's funny today. It was not funny then. So I get a call from one of the senior VPs who was my executive sponsor. And he reported to a guy named Al Weiss, who is the president of Walt Disney World. And Jim calls me and he's like, do you know me, need me to go to Al on your behalf? This is really bad. And I was like, how bad is it? He's like, the markets would have picked up on this saying, who's this guy that's in line to be president at Disney? Not good. I was like, no, don't go to Al. So HR shows up, asks me to sign a piece of paper that went into my personnel file. And let's just say Disney didn't fire me that day. But about a year later, I heard the footsteps coming and they were not singing. It's a small world after all. So I thought it was probably in my best interest that I take the leap. So I put my resume out, turned down 4 jobs, but ultimately decided that I would do my own thing.
Thank you for sharing the vulnerability of sharing the story. You were doing sales there, is that right?
Yeah, I was sales director for the Disney Institute.
How would you describe what you do now? You're developing people, you're keynote speaking, right? What made you want to make that pivot?
So here's the backstory, and no one has ever asked me that question. In 1999, Disney sent me to Paris to design a leadership program for 1,000 leaders out of Barclays Bank out of London. And while I'm there, Lion King had just come out, and I'm teaching the Disney principles, blah, blah, blah. And I literally hit this moment. People started coming up to me afterward, like, oh my goodness, that's phenomenal. Tell me more. And I went back to my hotel room that night in Paris, and I asked myself 3 questions. Number 1, what would I do if I knew I couldn't fail? Number 2, what would I do if no one paid me to do it? And number 3, what makes me come alive? And when I answered that 3rd question, I said, I want to speak, write, train, consult, and coach, and I would do it for the rest of my life. So literally, when I came back from Paris to Orlando, I realized I couldn't leave Disney right away, but I started to create an exit strategy. And I said, I'm going to figure out how to do this. So when I literally committed career suicide by saying I wanted to be the guy, I went back to that time in Paris and I said, I think this is the moment. I was 34 at the time. I got 4 job offers, 2 vice president's offers, a senior director offer from Flexjet, which represents all Learjet owners in the world, to be a customer care director, and an internal move at Disney. One of the senior VPs felt sorry for me and I said, nope, I'm going to go for it. So 22 years later, 54 countries and having a lot of fun. Best decision ever. But you know what, David? I bet there's a little something you don't know about The Lion King that I think your listeners would love.
Well, tell us. Come on.
So in the beginning of the movie Lion King, and Darren, you'll appreciate this, there's a scene where Rafiki holds up Simba and Simba sneezes.
Right.
99% of the movie-going audience doesn't notice the sneeze. But when Michael Eisner, then CEO, asked the question, why is the sneeze such a big deal? You have to remember when Lion King came out, it was pre-Pixar. So it took 100 animators to draw in the sneeze. So Michael Eisner says, we did it for the 1% that saw that we plussed up the experience. And that is the Disney difference. So every CEO, every leader listening to us right now, what's the plus up, that little something extra that you can't get anywhere, but it's the thing that people remember.
That is incredible. You know, it really is. And Simon, before we were even came on live, I was mentioning to you that I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old and a wife who's a huge Disney fan. And we went on a Disney cruise and I've been on a bunch of boat cruises before, but Disney does it like nobody else. I mean, they took it to the next level. You know, the connections that they made, and I've heard you talk about them that before in my research on you, connections they made and the experience they give. I mean, that's something that for our listeners and the leaders out there should really keep in mind, especially Simon, in really difficult times like today, totally. Right? That is so important. And so the other question I had for you is, what gave you the strength or the courage to make that leap? I know you had, you know, okay, you made that big mistake, career suicide mistake, but it still took a lot of guts to stick your neck out there and do what you did.
So one of my mentors, a guy named Dr. Mark Serona, said to me a number of years ago, he said, how are you doing? I said, you know, if I had white skin, blonde hair, blue eyes, it would be easy for me to succeed in America. And he said, you're stuck in your mind and your body. thinking the pigmentation of your skin limits you. You weren't born to fit in. You were born to be brilliant. And Darren and Damon, when he said it, it was like the 4th of July fireworks went off in me, because nobody ever told me that I was born to be brilliant. And Mark is white and a New Yorker from Italy. And he said, look, my wife and I adopted two young African-American boys, and we have been telling them what they can be instead of what they can't be. You need to unlock your brilliance. And literally, that started me on this whole journey. And I came across some of the research work of Dr. Howard Gardner, professor of education at Harvard, who studied that children up until the age of 4 are operating at the genius level. Same group of children were studied in their early 20s. Only 10% were still operating at the genius or brilliance level. And in their late 20s, early 30s, only 2% were operating at the genius or brilliance level. So I went down the rabbit hole. I said, where did the genius, or as I call it, brilliance, where did it go? It didn't go anywhere. It became buried by a society that says, color within the line, sit down, give it back, you can't do this. And the more a person continues to hear what they can't do, where they can't go, who they can't become, there is a neurological path that is creating the brain that causes individuals to shut down. So conformity robs people of creativity.
You hear about resilience, but you don't hear this idea of brilliance. It's literally like fireworks went off for you, and it changed your whole approach. But I have to say, it's hard for me to picture you not shining. Has this always been you, or did you kind of develop this brilliance personality?
So it's been a 20-year journey, and Dr. Sharona, when I first met him, he had 4,000 books in his library. He said, back your car up, open up your trunk, and take as many books as you can. I had never really read a book, you know, beyond college, and all of a sudden, I started reading and writing and processing, and I just went on this journey, and what I realized, there's a lot that I didn't know, and I had to come to a place where I say, I don't know what I don't know, but I'm open to learning. I heard a quote from Eric Hoffer, a noted philosopher. He said, in times of change, the learner will inherit the earth, while the unlearned will find themselves beautifully equipped to live in a world that no longer exists. And when I saw that quote, I'm like, I gotta learn forever, like never stop learning.
That reminds me of Gandhi's quote, where Gandhi says, live like today is your last day, but learn like you'll live forever.
I know some people are good with movies, but Simon, like, you've got all the best quotes just completely teed up and ready to go. You wrote a book, Resilience at Work, and How to Coach Yourself into a Thriving Future. And you took an interesting approach to the book. You kind of made a fable, but it's also an unusual choice. I was wondering the decision to make a book, the decision about writing it in this way, and then we can get into the book a little bit.
So years ago, I read Who Moved My Cheese, and I was so deeply impacted by the power of storytelling with a parable. And so I woke up 3 o'clock in the morning, God's honest truth, and I told my wife, Jody, my goodness, I'm going to write a book. And I have four characters. And she's like, what are you talking about? I said, their names are Hurry, Worry, Ready, Steady, plus Curious. And they're the personality archetypes. And she's looking at me like I have four heads, like, really, dude? Can you just go back to sleep? So what I realized is, as I was looking at the world in and out of organizations, this hurry personality is always moving fast. This worry personality is so concerned, waiting for the other shoe to drop. But then there's ready and there's steady. And at some level in life, over a 37-year career, I have been one of those four personality archetypes. So I wrote the book out of that place. But one of the things I decided to do, instead of telling the reader what to do, I invite them into a conversation for them to identify what is their next.
And in your book, I think you call that self-coaching, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how does that help the individuals become better through your self-coaching approach?
So one of the things is the quality of your questions determine the quality of your answers. So the moment you ask a question, it immerses you on a discovery to say, what's in the soup of my soul? What's laying at the bottom of the ocean of my spirit? And if I ask this question, what's going to come up? So when I invite people to ask that first question, What do you want for you? You're not waiting for HR or management or leadership to tap you on the shoulder. You realize that the best hand that will feed you in any economy is the one at the end of your wrist. And you're like, what can I do for me instead of waiting for the organization to make it happen for me?
Do you have any examples or either personal examples or how you've helped coach people come to that conclusion?
Oh my goodness, where do we start? Okay, I had a gentleman contact me about a year and a half ago. And he said, I'm trying to get ahead, but I'm not sure if this is the right place for me. I said, before you quit, I want you to ask yourself, have you given 100%? Have you reached out to other parts of the organization to find out what is working? And then have you gone to your leader and asked your leader, what can I do to help you succeed? And he's like, why should I do that? I said, because before you leave, you got to turn over every stone. Sure enough, he stayed, he got promoted because he began to take the light off of himself to say, how do I help my leader? And that leader began to change how they thought about him and was able to sponsor him in the organization.
What do you like better, coaching or keynote speaking?
I love it all. It's
I knew you were going to say that, but if I had to, I was like, tell us why. Let's hear some stories why.
Probably keynote is my love because this for me started 40 years ago at 15 years of age on a stage in Buffalo, New York, when I literally got cut from the football team. I went out for the basketball team and got cut, and I went out for track and field, and they said, my brother, you are too slow. You need to fly cross country. So my freshman year of high school was a total disaster. And my parents moved me to another school, and it was there that my teacher, Miss Relikas, may she forever rest in peace, my English teacher said, young man, I want you to give a speech and give it before the entire school. So 40 years later, a teacher saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. I love it. But the coaching is the one-on-one where you get to go deep.
What you said right there, somebody else saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. For all our leaders out there listening, that is so important. Because that's the impact you could have on people. Simon, my background is I played baseball my whole life, right? That was my thing. I was almost a professional baseball player. But what I didn't realize at the time that I realize now is that some of these coaches saw things in me that I never saw in myself that helped motivate me. And that's something that I try to do as a leader myself now, is keep in mind that the impact and the difference that you can make on individuals as a leader, as a parent, et cetera.
I was going to say the same thing, Damon. So much of what you said, Simon, from the brilliance to this thing right now, is your ability to hear, act on what people are seeing in you. So I guess, in a sense, it's paying that forward in what you do now too, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
I want to get a little bit back into the characters in a second. But before we go there, how do you bring that into the workforce, you know, through fostering a workforce that's resilient and brilliant?
Well, realize that every employee has a portfolio, and they will opt in to grow that portfolio in that organization or go elsewhere. I think the first thing everyone listening to us from today forward, you don't have any jobs to offer because job stands for just overboard. You have opportunities, and opportunities are what individuals begin to say, you know what, I'm going to go and make my mark because I can grow my portfolio of skills. And I grow my portfolio of skills because the company is investing in me and inviting me to step up even more. That's number one. Number two, when you realize that you are in the customer experience business, what is the employee experience? So you lose the language of we onboard people. No, you launch people. Because when you launch people, you put that hook in their jaw to say, my goodness, I want to stay because I've been launched into a destiny, a reality that allows me to grow more than ever. I think the third thing is, and this is something I learned the hard way. When I got promoted to my first leadership role at the Mouse House, I was a jerk of a boss. I was a boss with an agenda instead of a leader with a vision. And as you've heard the old adage, people don't lead companies, they lead managers who are clueless. So one of the things organizations have got to think about right now, there's a lot of focus on senior executive level development and frontline. The magic is in the middle. Middle management creates a subculture that causes a person to stay or go. So how are you developing middle managers who create that subculture that allows people to stay enlisted with their head, their heart, and their hands in the organization?
I'm so glad you gave a shout out to middle managers, because I agree. That's such an overlooked spot, right? I mean, they're doing all the hard work. Hurry, worry, ready, and steady. That's pretty good, right? It literally showed up while you were sleeping?
Literally.
So what advice are you giving people around these? And hands-on practical advice. What are you telling people?
So as I coach leaders, the first thing I invite them to think about, these personnel archetypes, they show up on their team. So for the worry personality, number one, tell them what they're doing right instead of what they're doing wrong, because they're going to always second guess. How am I showing up? I got this email. I got this text. What do they think? So you have to reassure them as to what they're doing right, number one. Number two, what is their appreciation language? Years ago, Disney was about to fire me, and I had to go to Disney University to find out how do you really create this culture for your team. And they talked about recognition. So I brought the team together, and I'm like, oh my goodness, Candace, you just had an amazing quarter. Candace turns flush red, runs out of the room. I'm like, ruh-roh, what just happened? And I sent Beverly, my assistant, after her, and Beverly came back and said, Candace doesn't like public recognition. So I said, Beverly, what do you think we should do? Because all women are right. And she said, what if you sent a handwritten note to her with a personal stamp thanking her and recognizing her? A few days later, Candace came into the office. She said, that's how I want to be recognized. So what would it be like to understand everybody's recognition or appreciation language? Here's the research. 1 minute spent on recognition creates 100 minutes of initiative. So we want people to move quicker, faster. How do we recognize them? But then the third thing, when you have your one-on-one meetings, ask this question. What is it that I can do to help you thrive? Asking that question invites them in. So if they got a foot out the door physically or mentally or emotionally, you ask that question. You're like, you know what? I may hang out a little bit because you want me to thrive. I've never heard that before. That means you want me to flourish.
Yeah, you know, the other thing it does, Simon, it helps them paint a picture in their mind what success looks like.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I really like what you said earlier about focus on what they've done well, right? Instead of hammering them on what didn't go well. And painting that picture to thrive, that is so key out there. And that goes back to bad bosses. Bad bosses don't do that. And people end up leaving. Out of these four characters, hurry, worry, steady, and ready. I think I've heard you say before that is worry the one that's most likely out there these days, or is it hurry?
It's really worry. And it's because of everything that's happening in the economy. Here's the research, the backstory. David Brooks wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times back in October 27, 2022, called The Rising Tide of Global Sadness. What he highlights in this New York Times article is that 50 years ago, all of the songs were about love, happiness. 50 years later, all of the popular pop songs are sadness, which interrupts how people show up. And they're just like, oh my goodness, the world is really heavy right now. But then they took it a step further. 50 years ago, headlines were positive. 50 years later, all the headlines. And as you know, if it bleeds, it leads. So all of that begins to weigh down on people, creating worry. Dr. Christian Mirescu and his research at Princeton University said, when the brain is worried, the brain slows down. When the brain slows down, it doesn't create neurogenesis, which is the process of forming neurons, which grows the brain. So if I show up at a place of business, in person or virtual, and I'm already worried about, oh my goodness, am I going to have a job next week? Is the company going to give me a raise? Am I going to have health insurance? Are they going to lay me off? I'm not able to be productive and take care of the internal or external customer. The new epidemic is loneliness. That's what's happening in many companies. And it's silent as well as trauma. From our research that we've done, emotional trauma is not being addressed in companies.
So let's bring some happiness in. That's what the mouse is all about, right?
Yes, yes. That's what leaders are going to focus on.
Simon, I think you said that 48% of people come to work and they're worried about the future. And they're worried about their future. And what you mentioned earlier about how it slows their brain down, they're obviously not as productive at work and they can't do as good of a job because they're worried, they're stressed. What advice do you have right now for a company that's not doing well? You know, there's a lot of uncertainty out there and the leader needs to get better at being transparent. What advice do you have for them?
Number one, leader, pull all of your leaders and managers together and check in on them and say, how are you doing? How are you doing from a mental health standpoint, emotional health? How are you doing? Start there. Number two, begin to be vulnerable by sharing, hey, I don't have all of the answers, but I need your brilliance. I need your help. What can we do? When people are invited to be a part of the solution of moving towards the future and they know that you're being transparent, you're not going to make it up, you're not going to float a balloon, but you want to say, how do we do this? It's those hard conversations that create that glue and that stickiness that pull teams together. It builds that resilience and that self-efficacy to say, wait a minute, our leader just said they don't have all the answers, but let's figure it out. And I think the third thing is, encourage them to go back and share with their teams what can we do instead of what we can't do. When I was going through this whole brilliance work, what I realized is that by the time a child is 17 years of age, they have heard no 150,000 times and only yes 5,000 times. So how do we become a yes culture? Ritz-Carlton teaches answers yes. Now what's the question? So wherever your company is right now, how do we find the yes and a no world, or to put a Disney spin on it, how do we become a plus in a minus world?
I have a couple of brand new grandsons. Now I'm thinking about how many times I say no. I'm going to have to be careful, especially as they hit two. All right. So here's one other thing that Damon and I were talking about, which is learning and resilience. And you have had a lot of pretty big learning moments in your life that could have just dragged you right down, but you didn't do that. And even for us, with the delegation class that I taught earlier today, in order to grow and evolve, you have to be willing to take some risks, to try some new things. You have to be able to have that resilience to bounce back, or you'll just always stay exactly the same. Can you talk a little bit about resilience and learning? Because I know, you know, obviously you care about learning. So
in our State of Work in America research, we asked working Americans, how do they define resilience? And they define resilience as perseverance, grit, some of Angela Duckworth's work. But then the third one surprised us, problem solving. And so what that said to us is, wait a minute, if I understand how to solve a problem, I learned something that I didn't know before, which gives me the confidence the next time I face, I don't know, but as Marie Forleo calls figure out ability, I'm going to figure it out. So that builds that resilience muscle to try just again a little bit more based on the history of, hey, I came through that. We discovered this. What if we try it this way?
Okay, let me see if I got that, because I think there's something interesting there too. Like, because I could imagine myself as if I solve problems quickly and easily, it's like good. But you're kind of saying figure out ability, which is you believe in your ability to solve a problem, and that's going to be a journey. It's like the journey of growth every time. It's a sort of hero's journey thing. It's not that I always solve it so quickly, but I believe in my figure out ability to get there. Is that right?
Yeah. And Darren, your figure out ability is not for you necessarily to have the answer. It's to be open enough to be on a team or a department or division to go and find the answer. And it's that curiosity that allows you to discover the best solution to solving the problem.
Now, Simon, to take it a step back, there's two things that leaders need to do. Number one, they got to start with hiring a diverse team with different perspectives.
Yeah.
And number two is they got to create a safe space to get their team comfortable enough to go out and use the figure ability, right?
Yes. Yes. So we have to give people space to realize that just because you fail doesn't mean you're a failure. Just because you make a mistake, it doesn't mean that you are a mistake. How do we bounce back and have an opportunity to discuss? What do we learn, unlearn, and re?
I have one other question that I wanted to get your perspective on, Because commonly the things that we know can help us with resilience in that sense of kind of like burnout and just being well is those four things of physical activity, nutrition, time with people you enjoy, and sleep. And it's really those four. Like, that's it. But even though we know it, we're still not doing it. So what advice do you have for people around the bedrock of resilience in that?
So I was interviewing Harry Kramer. Harry Kramer's former chairman and CEO of Baxter Healthcare and a professor at the Kellogg School. And I said, Harry, 40-year career, what do you know to be true? And he said, Simon, for the last 40 years, I asked myself three questions. These three reflection questions have become anchors. Question number one, how did I make a difference today? Question number two, how did I grow today? Question number three, what am I going to do better tomorrow? And it's those self-reflection questions that allow you to assess daily where you're going, what you can do better. John Maxwell says, consistency compounds over time. So when you consistently ask yourself those questions, self-reflecting, what you realize, you're just a little bit better than the day before. Just a little bit, because you challenge yourself.
So what I hear you say with that, Simon, is that emotional intelligence, EQ, plays a huge role in resilience.
Huge. Absolutely. Always reading the room, knowing where you are. A lot of my failure is I was emotionally clueless and I didn't get it. And after, you know, you hit your head up against the wall a few times, you know, my mother used to say, a hard head makes a soft bottom. And I got it.
Can you, to help put that in context for our listeners, can you share with us, if you don't mind, a story about where you could have been a little bit more self-aware?
So I was working for a leader at Disney, Larry, who I mentioned earlier, and I had to submit a report to him at the end of the week because I'm responsible for P&L. I had to share with him what were the activities that our team was doing, and he would mark it up in red and send it back to me. This is too tactical. It is not strategic, and this might end up on Michael Eisner's desk. So I went into his office one day and I slammed the door. I'm like, you don't support me. You are trying to hold me back. And it was not a very pixie dusted conversation. I mean, you could hear us down the hall. And he said, the reason I'm so hard on you is because one day you may be in this seat and I'm getting you ready. And it was just like a huge epiphany for me. Like, okay, that's what this was about. So resilience is about not hold your hand. You're so wonderful. It's that tough conversation that, like, buddy, you're a diamond in the rough. We got to polish you a little bit. So when you're in the room, you can actually be in the room and stay in the room, and they won't just see you as an empty suit. So it was a huge learning for me, and I had totally missed it as to what he was really trying to do to help me grow.
Okay, on another topic, are there really secret doors at Disney, and how do I get in one?
I don't know.
Still toeing the line, huh? Okay, all right, fine. Do you have any keynotes coming up or ones that you've done recently that were particularly fun?
I've been on tour for the last 6 months with a pharma company that is in the pet space, and I have been with vets from all over the country and some of the nicest people, sharing with them about customer experience and how they can create a better pet parent experience. And so it's been interesting because it's not my space, but I've gotten to know them and I've just fallen in love with the work that vets do. Some of the most compassionate people on the planet.
They are. They're great. And I love dogs. One thing that, that I want to make sure we get in, because I know we're kind of getting close on our time, is that right now is a very tough sales environment. There's a lot of uncertainty. You've been on both sides of the fence, sales, leading, keynotes, training. We have a lot of senior leaders who are sales leaders right now. What advice do you have for them?
Number one, serving is the new selling. When you call a customer to say, how can I best serve you? What is it that you need? It's not about what I can get from you. It's about what I can give to you, number one. Number two, how are you leaving an emotional tattoo on them every single time you engage? Quick little story. I got a call from my boss, Larry, at Disney. I had left, and he says, I want you to go to lunch with Michael. And I'm like, oh my goodness, Michael is an insurance guy. He's going to try to sell me an insurance policy. I'm like, I don't want to go. But I call Michael, and Michael says, hey, I want you to come for lunch to the and meet me at the Bay Hill Country Club. I'm like, wait a minute, the Bay Hill Country Club built by Arnold Palmer? Absolutely. So I show up on this particular day. I'm in my Sunday's best. We're sitting there, and I notice this guy hunched over in the corner. I'm like, that's Arnold Palmer. So being the bashful person that I am, I get up, I go over to Arnold Palmer. I said, hey, thank you for being a great American. Thank you for what you've done for the game of golf. And I proceed to take out my iPhone to take a selfie with Arnold Palmer. And this
Come on.
entourage behind him starts to close in. And Damon and Darren, I heard the soundtrack in my head, bad boys, what you gonna do when we come for you? This is probably not a good idea. So I go back up sitting with Michael. He's turned flush red.
He's like, I'm never inviting you anywhere again.
And at the end of the lunch, he didn't try to sell me insurance. A couple of weeks go by, I'm on stage speaking at an event. The host said, you can't leave the state. I'm like, why can't I leave the state? They said, we have something for you. They take out of this bag a hat from the Bay Hill Country Club that's been autographed by who?
Yeah.
Arnold Palmer.
Arnold Palmer.
I didn't realize Michael was in the audience that day. And guess what? He still didn't try to sell insurance to me. Net, net, Arnold Palmer passes. I call Michael. I buy three life insurance policies. Why? Because Michael understood when you sell, that's a transaction. But when you connect, that's a relationship. So everyone listening to us right now, how do we double down on emotionally connecting to what really moves people, not just trying to make our quota for the end of the month or quarter?
That is such great advice, because Simon, I feel like in times of uncertainty where sales are tough, the initial reaction is to jump in and try to oversell, right? And push, push, push. And it really doesn't work. I just got done interviewing the head of ticket sales for the Atlanta Braves, Paul Adams, for our show, and he was awesome. And during COVID, when everything shut down, his team, he didn't have any layoffs. He kept his team around, and all they did was contact their customers and talk to their customers like, how can I help you? How can we support you?
Wow.
And he said that that had a revolutionary effect and impact on customers moving forward. Because they were just thinking, okay, they're here to tell us we can't get refunds. They're here to tell us, to try to sell us prepackages, you know, to bring in revenue. He said they didn't do any selling, just like you said. They just asked them how they're doing and what they could do to help. And that's had an incredible effect on their business moving forward.
Wow. Wow.
So we are coming up on time. And so we have a signature question for you. I'm kind of interested, Darren, on this one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Tell us, Simon, something about you that is surprising that people don't know a lot about.
Well, everybody knows that. I used to play saxophone in school. Yeah, in nice. Middle school. I played saxophone. That was fun for me.
And do you still do it?
I don't. I love drums. So if I ever had a chance, I love to play drums. Yeah.
Well, I imagine you definitely stepping out on the stage and doing that at any opportunity. Your fearlessness and insights are so inspirational.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, for that. Just as a recap, some of the things that I'm taking away from today's session is it comes down so much to the questions you're asking yourself and of others. And when you get those questions right, you're challenging those defeatist, depressing, hurry, worry assumptions that we get stuck in so easily. And you have to just turn the tables for yourself and for others. And it's connected to brilliance. Like, that's where you find it. If you're looking to work on resilience, you kind of find it through your brilliance and the brilliance in others.
And all of us have brilliance in us, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, even you, Darren.
Okay.
So, Simon, how can our audience reach you? Where can they connect with you at?
Yeah, simontbailey.com and Simon T. Bailey on LinkedIn, throughout social media, Simon T.
And your book is called again?
Resilience at Work, How to Coach Yourself into a Thriving Future.
Thank you, Simon. You've been awesome today.
Thank you, guys.
For all our listeners out there, if you got value out of this, which I'm sure you did, please rate and review this episode. Tell a friend. And until next time, stay curious and keep learning. Have a good day, everybody.